Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today we are continuing Pride Week, and while we want to discuss the celebrations happening across the country, we're also keeping tabs on how LGBTQ plus communities and their allies are fighting back against the Trump administration. Yesterday, we talked about the drop in corporate support for Pride celebrations because of pressure from the administration, and today we're diving into the implications of their anti-gay policies. Important programs are being disbanded and defunded. NBC News reports that more than 270 National Institutes of Health grants, totaling at least $125 million, were eliminated in April. That includes research into reducing rates of HIV and STIs. There have been layoffs at the CDC and other federal agencies, which affect the government's ability to track HIV among gay men. Trump has rescinded anti-discrimination policies and eliminated DEI initiatives in the federal government. A leaked draft budget has the federal government completely eliminating funding for the 988 suicide and crisis line for LGBTQ plus youth. We did a show about that a few weeks ago. And it's not just at the federal level. California Governor Gavin Newsom's proposed state budget includes more than $17 million in cuts to a lesbian, bisexual, and queer women's health equity fund. So today we have a number of guests on the line with us who are going to help us unpack what's at stake here and how communities are fighting back. Cheryl Wayland is Senior Director of Special Initiatives and Partnerships at SAGE. That's a national advocacy group for LGBTQ plus elders. Cheryl Wayland has decades of experience in education, disability, and LGBTQ older adult advocacy. Hi, Cheryl. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me to be here today.
It's great to have you. Philip Hammack is professor of psychology and director of the Sexual and Gender Diversity Laboratory at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Hi, Professor Hammack. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
Good morning. And Danny Sesenya is director at the California LGBTQ Health and Human Services Network. Danny has over 15 years of experience working with nonprofits, particularly in creating transgender, gender diverse, and intersex healthcare collaborations. Danny Sesenya is the network's first Two-Spirit Native Director. Hi, Danny. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. Danny, I love that I learned that you're Two-Spirit in your bio. And I think many people are unaware of the term Two-Spirit and where it originated. Would you mind sharing that with us?
Sure, absolutely. In order to fully understand Two-Spirit identities, I think first, you know, we need to talk about the fact that in Native culture, women held positions of power. You know, women were leaders, were decision makers, healers, and keepers of knowledge. So there wasn't this patriarchal type of attitude within our culture. And women were very revered. So when we move over to Two-Spirit identities, you know, this is still a fairly new term. And this isn't a term that every Native culture or even tribe takes. This is, for many folks, even just a personal take as they're trying to figure out like where they fit in this society. And really, the term Two-Spirit emerged as a way to challenge colonistic understandings of gender and sexuality. So really, you know, within our culture and our community, you know, we've existed for thousands of years. You know, Two-Spirit is, you know, can do with gender expression, gender identity, sexual orientation. And we often held respected positions within our tribes. We served as healers, we served as spiritual leaders, and even cultural keepers as well. And we're often seen as we embody both male and female spirits, which allows us to bridge the gap within traditional gender roles that we've been taught and have grown up with. So even within my own family and community, I'm seen as my family's curandero, because I do engage in a lot of healing practices and such, and passing down our family stories.
I think this is so important, Danny, because you hear a lot of people thinking and saying that gender identity and trans are new terms, and they're wondering where this is coming from all of a sudden. But this is definitely not new.
No, it's not. If you look at various cultures around the world, outside of, Europe, let's say, in Mexico, you have a third term gender of mujer. You look at India, and they have another term of hijra. They have, I believe, over 200 different types of gender identity and gender expression just in India alone. You look in Africa and even Asian cultures and such. So we have existed for over a millennia, and we have been based due to colonization and to fit into a binary of male and female, and that the male gender is superior.
Yeah, very important history, Danny. Thank you for laying that out for us. And I think we need to do an entire show about this because the history around this is so important. Danny Sesenya is director at the California LGBTQ Health and Human Services Network. What's interesting, Phil, about what Danny just said is you're pointing out that so many people in the Gen Z community identify as trans or they them. And as a result, you say that you actually have a positive view of where we're going here because sexual and gender diversity is not going away.
Exactly. No, it's very clear when we look at the data. You know, the Gallup has a phenomenal data set, national data set that they started tracking in 2012. And if you look at identification with any form of LGBT plus identity starting in 2012 and going to today, it has tripled in number in the general population. And when you look even more closely, they break it up by generation. And you can see very clearly dramatic rises in identification with some form of gender or sexual diversity among members of Generation Z. So people born starting 1997 through 2012, and you have almost 25% of Generation Z is identifying with some form of LGBT identity. And if you look across the generations, it just keeps going up and up and up. And I think that what's happening is, you know, visibility, thanks to social technologies starting this century, more and more people can have the confidence to come out, to be authentic in their gender and sexuality. And that is not going to change, regardless of what happens, I think, with federal funding of research, that context of heightened visibility is here to stay.
What are you hearing from the youth at UC Santa Cruz? Because while for the first time, really, people are able to really be who they are and express themselves,
Yeah.
we are seeing just so many policies at the federal level to try to smash all of this. So what are you hearing from students?
Well, I think more than anything, shock, confusion, disbelief. I mean, they've grown up in a context where they've seen this heightened and sort of, you know, ever increasing ability to be authentic in their gender and sexuality. And so to have what feels like this really radical break where their very existence is being questioned. I mean, particularly with the executive order around that sort of denies the existence of gender identity as a concept at all and claims that there's only two genders and they're based on assigned sex at birth. I mean, this flies in the face not only of science, but of the experience of young people who have really been brave in saying, like, you know, the gender that I embody is not consistent with the sex I was assigned at birth. And so, you know, they've been in the driver's seat of this basically revolution this century. And so for them, it's very concerning and very disorienting what's happening.
And I think I would love to do another show about this, Phil, but you have a lot of people who are confused about this. They might be threatened by this. And you hear some people say, how is it all of a sudden that so many people are trans? Or we hear they, them more than ever among the young community. How did this happen all of a sudden? But isn't it the case that it's just in past generations, they just weren't, quote, allowed to be who they wanted to be? And so they had to just fit in a gender box and conform to what people considered gender norms in past generations?
Absolutely. I think that ties in really nicely to Danny's point. I mean, these concepts of gender and sexual diversity have long existed across cultures, across history. There's a lot of evidence that whether it's something we might consider, you know, like transgender identity today or gay or lesbian identity has long, long, long existed. It's just that people have not been able to be authentic because they haven't had those opportunities provided in the culture. And that's what's really different about the 21st century is that thanks to things like social media, internet, social technology, we really have the capacity to be more and more open about who we are.
Philip Hammack is professor of psychology and director of the Sexual and Gender Diversity Laboratory at UC Santa Cruz. Cheryl, you work with older LGBTQ people, and some of the conversations I've loved in the past have been with older activists and younger activists. And the older activists have just talked about how amazing it's been to see young people just say, we're not going to deal with this anymore. We want to be who we want to be, and we want to be open. And that's it. It's that simple. So can you talk a bit about, you know, what you're hearing from some of the older LGBTQ people that you're working with, the people who've been at this for decades, and what do they make of this moment?
Yeah, I think that's such an important point in time to just think about, you know, our generations and the experiences that our LGBTQ plus elders have lived through, and also how they're finding inspiration in our younger generations today. You know, it's also really important to recognize that I think for a lot of folks, they may think they've never met a person who identifies as transgender, but in reality, they probably have. We have many older adults who transitioned 20, 30, 40 years ago, and people simply see them for who they are and may not recognize, you know, that they are a transgender older adult. And so it's really important that we recognize that and to remember, you know, as we're talking about pride, that, you know, pride was really an outgrowth of the Stonewall riots in New York City. And, you know, those were led by Black transgender women. And so it's important that we recognize that our transgender older adults have been here and continue to be here, and they're resilient, and they're really showing us the way forward, you know, along with younger generations. So I just want us to recognize, you know, how important this time is for our transgender older adults as well.
And I'm sure you work with a lot of people who had to conform to the, quote, gender norms of the past because of the communities in which they lived, because of their families, for example. And then decades later, they were finally able to be who they have always been. I mean, we all know someone like this, or we've all heard stories about this.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. Many older adults come out later in life, and it's oftentimes, you know, because they weren't allowed to in their communities. They didn't feel safe. They may have feared losing their jobs if they came out, losing their family. And so there's many reasons why a person may have not come out until later in life. And so it's really inspiring also to listen to older adults who are able to now really feel like they're living their authentic selves, and how important it is to also support them in this journey.
Cheryl Wayland is Senior Director of Special Initiatives and Partnerships at SAGE, a national advocacy group for LGBTQ plus elders. Today, we are continuing our week of Pride celebrations and shows. And while we want to talk about the celebrations happening across the country, we, of course, have to talk about the Trump administration's anti-LGBTQ plus policies. And what a time, really, to be alive at a time when so many young people are just changing so much and really embracing who they are and changing vocabulary. I mean, I'll be honest, I'm Generation X, and it took me a while to figure out they and them. I mean, it's just, it's a learning process for a lot of people, and that's fine. But let's have conversations about all of this. So while young people are really at the forefront, here we have all of these attacks on LGBTQ plus communities and, you know, really going after research. So how are you seeing this moment? What comes up for you as you hear our guests talk about this moment in time? We'd love to hear from you. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. So I'd love to find out how you all are keeping up with all of this, what you're hearing from your communities in terms of the Trump administration really going hard after the LGBTQ plus community. Cheryl, your group SAGE did some analysis last year on Project 2025. We did a whole series on Project 2025 before the election, and you all broke down the consequences that Project 2025 could have on queer elders, particularly on issues like healthcare and housing. Can you talk about what was in the project and then what parts of the project has the administration implemented so far?
I'll be honest, I'm not an expert on the project, but I would say that, you know, we're seeing Project 2025 unfold in front of us. And, you know, the concerns around healthcare, if there are cuts to Medicare and Medicaid, you know, that has a direct impact on older adults, including our LGBTQ plus older adults. And so access to quality healthcare is key. And then when we think about housing, you know, housing is healthcare. And many of our older adults also, you know, rely on subsidies to help ensure that they can remain in the community. And so all of these things really are, you know, a concern, not only for our LGBTQ plus elders, but all older adults across the country. You know, who at a time in their lives when, you know, it's not always possible to increase your income. Many folks are living on fixed incomes. And so cuts to Medicare, Medicaid, housing supports, those are all, you know, a direct impact on the health, safety, and well-being of older adults, including our LGBTQ plus older adults.
And what's hard about this is, in addition to those federal cuts, Governor Newsom just came out with a new budget because of the shortfall at the state level. Cheryl, has SAGE been also following that budget?
We've heard about that. Not being in California, that might be a better question for...
Oh, I'm sorry. You're right. You're not in
California. That's okay. Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's the hard part is... So there's federal cuts, but then there's state cuts really across the country.
Right. Yeah, and you know, I think at a federal level, we're seeing that in all states where, you know, I think everyone right now is really in a budget crisis. And so I think we're going to continue to see cuts across the country, and those will be impacting LGBTQ plus communities like they have in California.
Danny, what are you really focusing on? What do you think deserves more attention? We mentioned this NBC News piece about cuts to LGBTQ health research, and Benjamin Ryan starts the piece by writing, "The nation's LGBTQ research field is collapsing because of all of these grants being eliminated." So what do you think deserves more attention, given that so much is going on?
You know, to be honest, it just feels like a whirlwind because everything is being cut right now. We lost our own NIH research grants, which really harms, you know, to really track, you know, what is going on with LGBTQ health disparities. Where does the governor need to direct funding? What types of programmings needs to be developed within the California Department of Public Health, within the California Health and Human Services arena and such? But, to be honest, and to kind of go back to your previous question that you asked about the governor's budget, the governor back in his May revise, for the 25-26 state budget, he had proposed eliminating funding for several groundbreaking health initiatives, including the California Reducing Disparities Project, the LGBTQ Health Equity Initiative, the Reproductive Justice Fund, as well as support for LGBTQ foster youth. All of these programs addresses LGBTQ health disparities. And really what we had to do is we had to partner with a few of our major partners across the state, including the LA Center, Equality California, Planned Parenthood and such. And we had to form what we call now a health equity coalition. And we rallied LGBTQ community members and organizations from across the state to put pressure on both the Senate and the Assembly to advocate for the full restoration of this funding. And mind you, this funding was, again, more than $40 million that was going to be taken away from our communities. And with our advocacy and with our push and really talking to these legislatures, when the budget revision came out again on Monday, with the legislature proposal, it showed that the funding had been reinstated. So it shows that when our communities rise up and fight back, the legislature listens and they're realizing that this is more than just a budget line, but it's a lifeline for LGBTQ programming and mental health services, especially for our vulnerable youth. But what we need now is that pressure on Governor Newsom to prove that he's heard this same message and to sign the budget that will protect these essential health programs.
What is the deadline for people who want to speak up about this?
Yes, so the deadline is June 15th is when everything needs to be signed. It could go longer, but the new fiscal year starts July 1st. So folks need to call their legislature now, today, tomorrow, tonight. Encourage their family and their friends to call as well, because the more pressure we can put on Governor Newsom and for the legislature to put on Newsom, the better chance of us saving these essential programs.
This is really important because we talked about Governor Newsom's budget last week. And one of the changes that got a lot of reaction from our listeners would reinstate the Medi-Cal asset limit of $2,000 per individual and $3,000 for couples to qualify for care, which is so incredibly low. And a lot of people are afraid that they're going to lose their Medi-Cal because of this. Danny, can you also talk about that? That's a major change if it goes through.
Yeah, it definitely is a major change with the asset test, with the fact that he's also proposing that the immigrant community pays $100 premium every month. And if folks do not pay that $100 premium every month, then they will lose their access to Medi-Cal. There's also the loss of dental services and such. So, and again, these are vital lifelines. This is healthcare should be accessible for everyone, regardless of your income, regardless of your socioeconomic status, regardless of your gender identity, sexual orientation, immigration status, and such. And this can have severe harms on our entire community. But then, if you look at the even bigger picture of the fact that the federal government wants to gut Medicaid, which is California's Medi-Cal, that means even more people are going to lose their access to healthcare. And if we're just talking about the transgender community, we have about 36,000 transgender folks who rely on Medi-Cal, not just for gender-affirming care, but just to take care of their diabetes, their heart conditions, any other pre-existing conditions. So we need to stop this negative narrative of we need to ban gender-affirming care, we need to ban, all of these different things, and look at the impacts of the fact that people can literally die without access to care when we make it inaccessible.
Wow, 36,000.
Yes, and that's just in California alone.
Well, if you want to speak out about California Governor Gavin Newsom's budget, the deadline is on Sunday, June 15th, and we will definitely continue to do shows to bring you updates. Danny Sesenya is director of the California LGBTQ Health and Human Services Network. He's the network's first Two-Spirit Native director. Cheryl Wayland is senior director of special initiatives and partnerships at SAGE, a national advocacy group for LGBTQ plus elders. Philip Hammack is professor of psychology and director of the Sexual and Gender Diversity Laboratory at the University of California, Santa Cruz. On today's Your Call, we're continuing Pride Week. We're keeping tabs on how LGBTQ plus communities and their allies are fighting back against the Trump administration and also Governor Newsom's potential cuts. You can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. We have a number of caregiving events coming up, and we hope you can join us in person if you're in the Bay Area. On Saturday, June 21st, we've got a caregiving event happening at our space at 220 Montgomery in San Francisco, 11 a.m. to 3. We're going to have information centers for caregiving for families, caregiving for seniors. I'll be sharing my caregiving story at 1 o'clock. So that is Saturday, June 21st, 11 a.m. to 3 at 220 Montgomery in San Francisco. And then we're going to have a live Your Call caregiving show on Wednesday, July 9th at the San Francisco Public Main Library, 6 p.m. You can find more information at kalw.org. Today, we are continuing our week of Pride shows. We're talking about celebrations happening across the country, and we're keeping tabs on how LGBTQ plus communities and their allies are fighting back against the Trump administration and in California, fighting against Governor Newsom's potential cuts. You can join us at 866-798-8255. What are your thoughts on this moment where so many young people are really saying, we're not going to take it anymore with these gender norms. We want to be who we want to be. And that's it. It's pretty simple. Of course, the administration's not making it simple for them. So what are your thoughts about this moment? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Cheryl Wayland is Senior Director of Special Initiatives and Partnerships at SAGE, a national advocacy group for LGBTQ plus elders. Philip Hammack is Professor of Psychology and Director of the Sexual and Gender Diversity Laboratory at UC Santa Cruz. Danny Sesenya is director at the California LGBTQ Health and Human Services Network. He's the network's first Two-Spirit Native director. And let's hear from a caller. Let's go to John in Berkeley. Hi, John. Thanks for holding.
Good morning, Rose. And thank you so much for your work. And thank you, all of your doctors, for your great work.
Oh, thank you.
And so my point is really the connection. I'm a historian. And the connection between this and the Nazi seizure of power, that a fascist takeover needs a scapegoat, and a trans person is the last taboo. And so an easy mark to attack, and everyone's afraid of trans people. So the fascists attack them, and it's and militarize the National Guard, federalize, I should say, but and the Marines are, you know, they're trained to kill people. It's an abomination, but it's directly connected with the treatment of gay people and trans people. They're an easy mark. You know, and by mark, I mean target.
Well, thank you for that. Thank you for the call, John. You made me think about the ads that we saw in the lead up to the election. There's a piece at Truthout. Republicans spent nearly $215 million on TV ads attacking trans rights. Civil rights attorney Alejandra Caraballo said that's $134 per trans person in anti-trans ad spending. It's the biggest type of ad run by far by Republicans. That was their closing message. Phil, what are your thoughts on this and what John just laid out there?
Well, I think that's a really, really insightful observation. I mean, just for a second little moment in history here, you know, the real birth of sexuality science occurred in 19th century Germany. And there was an Institute of Sexual Science led by a guy named Magnus Hirschfeld, who was a pioneer in identifying transgender experience and identity, and even I think did some of the first gender affirmation procedures. The entire institute was burned down by the Nazis, destroyed by the Nazis. And what we saw, this is why this authoritarian fascism playbook doesn't work when it comes to advancing cultures and societies, because what we saw was the Nazi destruction of science, destruction of the knowledge production industry in Germany, obviously resulted in a huge decline for Germany and German culture. But there is a redemptive story here, which is that, you know, it did not work in the long run. Now, of course, nobody wants us to get to the point of what happened in Nazi Germany. And I think that we've got the ability today to counter what's happening. And that's where I see, you know, optimism in the protests, optimism in the lawsuits that are directly coming at the administration, and that frankly, most of which are succeeding. And so, you know, even though I think there is a historical analogy, I think it's going to turn out much better for us than it did at that point in time. But I appreciate the caller.
Yeah, thank you so much, John. When we do shows like this, I'm always concerned about LGBTQ youth, because language has consequences. You know, constantly talking about trans people and LGBTQ people in the media in such a negative way has consequences. And so I wonder what your thoughts are, Philip, about how media should be reporting on this. I'm just looking at a recent report from GLAAD. They found that between May 1st of last year and May 1st of this year, there were 932 anti-LGBTQ incidents in 49 states and DC. That's about 2.5 incidents every day. 52% of all incidents were specifically targeting trans and gender non-conforming people. Violent attacks included 84 injuries and 10 deaths. Eight of these involved people of color. So words have consequences. How do you think we should be talking about these issues?
Absolutely. Well, I think, one, we need to be acknowledging the truth that transgender people do exist, that there are more than two genders, that these are scientific realities. So I think that there needs to be, you know, an explicit acknowledgement that what the administration is putting out is in fact its own ideology. It is calling, you know, the science, it's actually calling it gender ideology, but the reality is they're putting out an ideology that's not grounded in the facts of science, of what we know. And the consequences are it will enable or embolden violence against people who are seen as other. We know this from decades and decades of social psychological research. Once you delegitimize, you dehumanize, you put people in this other category, it actually condones violence. And that's what we're seeing just, you know, time and time again.
Danny, what would you add?
Oh, this violence. This is where it just hits home so hard. Just yesterday, I was in a meeting with a colleague who was having a really difficult time because they had found out that a prominent trans woman in a prominent trans organization in LA was detained by ICE, you know, and this is just hitting really, really close to home for so many of us. We're just terrified of, like, you know, this weekend's supposed to be Trans Pride. Is it safe to still go? This organization asked me to speak at an event on how to engage in health policy and advocacy for the community. And now they're just wondering, like, do we keep it in person? Do we move to online and such? And this is legitimate fears of the community because now they're attacking our events. They're coming to our events. And if we can't even go to a safe space, a community center where we can be amongst each other and receive mental health services and support group services, then where can we go where it's safe? And this is just the reality right now.
Well, and to your point, so this weekend is trans events happening across the country. It's also Trump's military parade. I'm just looking at photos of troops on, I'm sorry, military tanks on the streets. I mean, it's very surreal to see this. And he has said if anyone protests his military parade, they're going to crack down hard. So the timing of all of this, when you think about it, Danny, you've got the ICE raids going on in LA, the military being called to LA. He says he might send troops to other countries. And then you've got his military parade with tanks. They're going to be rolling down the streets of DC. We've never seen anything like that, I mean, in modern times. And then you've got all of these LGBTQ events and celebrations happening.
Yeah, that's very true. And honestly, I was in DC this past weekend attending World Pride, and I was really anticipating, a heavy military presence and such. And luckily, there was not. And what really made me excited and happy was that DC was literally covered in rainbows. Rainbows absolutely everywhere. Queer people walking around openly and loving one another. And it was just so amazing to see how Washington, D.C. itself is embracing the LGBTQ community. But what did break my heart was seeing all of the fences start to go up around the National Mall and around the White House in preparation for the parade, and to start seeing the military presence start to seep in on Monday morning. And that's where it's like, okay, this is where reality's hitting. This is where it's at. But what gave me a lot of hope was that the actual city, actual Washington, D.C., pretty much gave the middle finger and was like, no, we love our LGBTQ community. We are embracing them. Every restaurant, every hotel, every store had rainbow and trans flags absolutely displayed everywhere. And that just made me so happy and so welcomed and gave me hope. It really gave me hope, and it really reinvigorated me to be like, you know what? I can continue on this fight, because I was starting to get really tired, really depressed. And it just, just really gave me like that fire again. Like, you know what? I'm gonna do this. I can keep doing this. I can keep fighting.
I'm sure so many people relate to what you're saying there, Danny. Cheryl, what are you hearing from the people you work with, LGBTQ plus elders who've been at this for so long? I'm sure they can relate to what Danny is saying, that they're tired. How are they here fighting for basic rights? But at the same time, as Danny says, Washington, D.C. was awash in rainbow flags over the weekend.
Yeah, one of our taglines at Sage is we refuse to be invisible. And it's actually our rallying call. It's a way for us to challenge, what's happening right now and to tell our stories, to speak out, and to really lead with that sense of resolve and resilience. And that's where I take inspiration from our LGBTQ plus elders, because many of them, have lived through these times before, and they can help guide us and really share their wisdom with us. And so I think it's so important that we also remember our elders, what they've experienced, and how this may also be a point of trauma for them as well when they think about their past experiences, potentially with violence, at the hands of police, at the hands sometimes of the military. And so it's really important that we also remember, that our elders have lived through this. They've survived it, and they continue to lead with that sense of resilience and resolve.
Cheryl Wayland is Senior Director of Special Initiatives and Partnerships at SAGE, a national advocacy group for LGBTQ plus elders. Phil Hammack is Professor of Psychology and Director of the Sexual and Gender Diversity Lab at UC Santa Cruz. Danny Sesenya is Director at the California LGBTQ Health and Human Services Network. He is their first Two-Spirit Native Director. If you'd like to join us, we've got about 15 or so minutes left. You can call us at 866-798-8255. What are your thoughts about this moment? What are your thoughts about all of these cuts that we're seeing? If you or someone you know has been affected or will be affected, if you work at an organization that works with LGBTQ people, how are you all responding to what we're seeing right now? Are you planning to go out onto the streets? If you have been on the streets, what have you seen and experienced? 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. We're getting a few emails from listeners who are wondering how to be the best allies at this time, given that so much is happening and so much is at stake. Danny, what is the best way to be an ally right now?
The best way to be an ally right now is basically donate. Donate to your local LGBTQ center, because right now they are losing funding left and right. Whether, you know, it's through research grants, community grants, through other donors, you know, who are terrified of just donating because of, you know, they're afraid of an IRS audit and this current administration. Donate where you can to your local LGBTQ center. And then on top of that, donate to your local immigration rights organizations as well. Again, LGBTQ folks, we are intersectional beings. We are also immigrants. We're out there protesting. So please also donate to those immigration organizations. And the other thing is call your legislatures and call the governor and keep encouraging them to support LGBTQ programming and services within the state budget.
Cheryl, what would you add? What's the best way to be an ally?
You know, I would say reach out to the LGBTQ plus people in your circle. Your family members, your neighbors, the person who goes to church with you, reach out to them and show your support. You know, also at SAGE, we have what we call the SAGE Action Squad. And, you know, this is a place where people can sign up and get alerts on issues that are important to LGBTQ plus elders. And we encourage our allies to also be a part of that work and to join us, you know, in the work for LGBTQ plus older adults across the country.
And Phil, what are your thoughts about this administration's end game? Because they're obviously going so much further this time than they did in the first administration. In his first term, Trump launched what he called Ending the HIV Epidemic, a plan for America, which expanded access to PrEP and other HIV prevention and care services. Many people said it was actually working. HIV rates were declining. But now his administration is cutting funding and threatening that progress. So what do you think explains this?
Well, it is really difficult to fully understand what is behind what appears to me to be sort of an end game of cultural destruction. I mean, the slogan is "Make America Great Again," but it, you know, whether it comes to the economy and trade, immigration, and our sort of long tradition of being a welcoming nation for immigrants. I mean, my grandparents were immigrants. You know, or whether it comes to scientific advancement, being a leader in science, all of that is on the very significant, very fast decline. So I don't really understand what's behind this, besides what seems to me to be some kind of commitment to a relatively fringe and, you know, sort of uninformed ideology, frankly. So that my only hope is how can we put the brakes on as much as possible so that less damage is done? And I think the one thing that I would add to what my colleagues said in terms of allyship is make sure you're registered to vote and vote. And I'm speaking especially to the allies who are between the ages of 18 and say 25, 29, who historically don't always turn out for midterm elections. So we really do have to put the brakes on this.
Yeah, we've done some shows about the 90 million people who did not vote this time around for a variety of reasons. And we have to keep talking about that. A lot of people said, I just feel like the parties are not talking to me. The Democrats are not talking about working class issues, and I'm not voting. So we have to keep talking about that. Danny, what are your thoughts here? Why do you think they're going so hard this time around? I mean, they went hard the first time, but this is different. What is happening? What's the end game here?
I just to be a little controversial here, I think the end game is, us becoming like Nazi Germany. I think that what we're seeing with the protests and the military presence is a test of, how far can we take things? I really do believe in the first administration that he really learned the ins and outs of how the federal government works, the types of people he needs in there to get to his agenda and such. And he's playing it a lot smarter, whether it's him or the people that are working behind him. But there definitely is a game plan, and Project 2025 is definitely the playbook that they're going by. And my biggest fear, taking off my advocate and activist hat is, are we going to end up with the pink triangles again? Does me and my family need to start planning on, do we need to eventually flee and such? That's not where I would love my mind to go. That's not the type of fear I want to incite in my community at all. But it is something that's in the back of my head because I'm just seeing the writing on the wall. History repeats itself, and we're just seeing everything that happened in Germany with Hitler that played out from after World War I all the way up through World War II is taking place again. So those are thoughts that I'm having, and that's what I'm terrified of. And whether it be controversial or not, that's my honest opinion.
Well, to your point, I saw a piece this morning, a photo posted by Castaneda's Marketplace in Windsor, California. This is a place where people go to buy groceries. There was an ICE raid there, and there are photos of ICE agents wearing their gear with their guns, and they are basically corralling brown women. And Castaneda's Marketplace said, we struggled with whether or not to post this. We know we're a market, we're a place for groceries. And they talk about what happened in 1940s Germany when Jewish people were hunted where they lived and worked. And they said, we need to speak up. Latinos, many undocumented, they can't hide. They have to make money to feed their families. So to your point, Danny, and this is happening as we speak. They're cracking down in the agriculture fields of California and at this grocery store in Windsor.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And even my own grandparents, I had to have a difficult conversation with them yesterday because, they live out in Hemet and California, and it's a very rural area. And they went to the store and they saw ICE there, and just asking people, do you have your papers? Let us see documentation. And they had to walk all the way around the store and the shopping center to get to their car because they were terrified. Even though that they're from here, they asked me, they're like, Mijo, we're brown, we're very nopal, and we want a copy of our birth certificates on us. Can you get us a copy of our birth certificates? And if we're scared to go out, can you go to the grocery store for us? And mind you, I live in LA, a good 2 hours away from them. And I told them, yes, I'll be out there this weekend. I'll go grocery shopping for you. You need to go to the doctor's next week. Like, let me know your doctor's appointment schedule. I'll take you, or we'll see how we can make it virtual. This is real life right now. My own family is terrified to go to the doctors. And my grandfather is a Vietnam veteran diagnosed with Agent Orange who's losing his limbs, and he's terrified to even go to his own VA. So what does that tell us about our current situation? Take away the fact that I'm queer and just put on the fact that my grandparents who served this country can't even live their regular life right now.
I'm so sorry, Danny, and so many families are going through this right now. We did a show actually a couple days ago about how people who've been rounded up, their loved ones have no idea where they are. And I wrote them to find out if they have any updates, and we haven't heard back, but we will bring you an update. We did actually hear back from the Trevor Project about the 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline, and the Department of Health and Human Services just shared their budget proposal, and it does still call for the elimination of this line. They are asking people to call members of Congress to ensure that this line d is not eliminated. So we just wanted to bring you that update. Thank you for sharing that story, Danny, and I'm so sorry your family's going through that. Cheryl, final thoughts from you. Are you working with LGBTQ elders who have any similar stories to Danny's, whose families are now living in fear?
I think this story is being repeated across the country, sadly. And, it really is our opportunity to step up, to speak up, to be active, to stand with our neighbors, and to help rewrite the end to this story. The last chapter hasn't been written yet, and it's up to us to really take a stand and help lead the way. So that's, I just call on everybody to do what you can to stand with your neighbors, who are experiencing these true fears today.
And Phil, final thoughts from you. We have about a minute left.
Yeah, I mean, I want to end on a somewhat optimistic note that kind of the way I started, that, young people have initiated a revolution in this century and it can't be stopped. And so we've just got to mobilize and come together to fight this.
Philip Hammack is professor of psychology and director of the Sexual and Gender Diversity Laboratory at UC Santa Cruz. Cheryl Wayland is senior director of special initiatives and partnerships at SAGE, a national advocacy group for LGBTQ plus elders. Danny Cesena is director of the California LGBTQ Health and Human Services Network. He is the network's first Two-Spirit Native director. Cheryl, Phil, and Danny, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank
Thank
you.
you.
Thank you. And we will definitely continue to follow these issues. Tomorrow, we are going to talk about how the administration is hitting the trans community, and we'll talk about how the trans community is fighting back. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering today's show. Thanks to Andrew Stelzer for producing our show. And thank you so much for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.